herzlich willkommen zu einer neuen Sonderfolge des FAZ-Bücher-Podcasts zur Frankfurter Buchmesse. Am FAZ-Stand ist diesmal zu Gast der Autor Colson Whitehead und er spricht mit Patrick Barners über seinen Roman »Die Nickel Boys«. Es geht um ein jahrelang beschwiegenes Verbrechen und Colson Whitehead erzählt das fiktionalisiert, aber eng an den Tatsachen entlang. Mit seinem letzten Roman Underground Railroad hatte er einen ganz besonders großen Erfolg.
Guten Tag, meine Damen und Herren. Herzlich willkommen hier am Buchmessen Samstag am Stand der Frankfurter Allgemeinen Zeitung. Mein Name ist Patrick Barners. Ich arbeite in der Feuilleton-Redaktion und ich bin sehr froh, dass Colson Whitehead zu uns gekommen ist und werde mit ihm sprechen über seinen neuen Roman, die Nickel Boys. Und mit Ihrer Erlaubnis werde ich jetzt ins Englische wechseln und wir werden unser Gespräch auf Englisch führen. So, we are very proud to have you here. You have a very busy schedule in Germany, giving readings from the new novel. So it's very kind that you also come and visit us here at our newspaper. Many people here who come here, I see you draw a very big crowd, of course, will have read your the last novel, Underground Railroad, which was a big success, I suppose, everywhere in the United States. You won the National Book Award as well as the Pulitzer Prize, and it also attracted a great deal of attention in Germany. But actually, all of your novels, this now is your seventh novel, all of your novels were published in Germany, so German readers sort of do already know you quite well. And I think we can also give a shout out to the Hansa Verlag, who published almost all of them, and are sort of very very faithful and to you and the case of American literature.
So yeah, I'm very glad Hansa stayed with me. Some books did better than others, and I think in England I've had like 6 publishers. Basically, if you published me in England, you would go bankrupt or get fired immediately afterwards. And so I've been very fortunate. Hanser has not gone bankrupt, and they've published most of my books. Yeah.
So in order just to make sure whether there was maybe anything in your oeuvre which hasn't been translated yet, I checked the catalog of our Deutsche Nationalbibliothek, sort of the Library of Congress, which is based here in Frankfurt, our library of reference, which takes everything in. And I checked the catalog, and I was very relieved to find that almost all of your books were indeed translated. But I stumbled on the entry where you you find your name, the date of birth, and your profession, and it says Colson Whitehead, journalist. So I was wondering, is this a mistake, or would you consider yourself a journalist?
No, well, I mean, I worked at the Village Voice newspaper in New York. It was my first job out of college, and I was there from 91 to 96, and I was an arts critic. I did book and TV and film reviews. For me, journalist has always been, Woodward and Bernstein, like you actually talk to people. I hate talking to people. Investigate and do that real footwork. And so, but I did work at a newspaper for 6 years, and so technically I was a journalist for a while.
Yes, and maybe metaphorically there is at least a little grain of truth in this entry in the catalog of the Deutsche Nationalbibliothek. Because turning now to your new novel, it's based on a true story, and it's actually also based on the fieldwork of journalists. And you can come across the story by coming across the work of these journalists.
Yeah, it was the summer of 2014, and I was on Twitter goofing off as I usually do, And the story of the Dozier School, this very repressive reform school, had been covered a lot in Florida. And one day in 2014, it bubbled up to the national media. The school had closed in 2011, and they were going to sell the land, and they discovered 55 unmarked graves, students who died years before, some of them from natural causes, some of them had shotgun pellets in their rib cages, some of them had blunt force trauma to their skulls, and so they've been killed. And it was the reporting of Ben Montgomery and others, Tampa Bay Times, local journalists, who kept the story going and provided me with a lot of information about how the school worked, and was my first exposure to what happened at this place.
And you called the novel The Nickel Boys, so you gave the school a fictional name. So who are these Nickel Boys of the title?
Sure. The Dozier School that the Nickel Academy is based on was a reform school, and basically in the 19th century there was a very lofty idea that instead of locking up juvenile offenders with adult criminals, why not have a separate facility where they can have school one day, work the next day, learn a trade, farming, so that when they come out, they'll be productive members of society and not hardened criminals. The school opened in 1900, but immediately, you know, disturbing reports made their way out into the outside world. As early as 1903, they found kids as young as six shackled and put in solitary confinement. And over the school's 111-year history, you know, periodically investigators or journalists would expose some of the problems, and there'd be talk about reform, and then people would stop talking about it, and then it would happen again, and more reforms would be promised and then ignored. So that was a cycle. People would hear about it and basically do nothing. The students were poor. The majority of the students were African American, and who's going to look out for these people? And apparently, it was nobody. And so, I took most of the facts of the school and kept them for my school, the Nickel Academy, but invented all the characters. So they're made up, but the place is very much real.
And that's the main character, who goes by the name of Elwood Curtis. And at first we meet him at liberty, still at home, as a pupil living in Florida, living with his grandmother, and studying and planning to go to college. And then when there's this one instance of bad luck, and although he himself hasn't done anything wrong, he gets caught by the police, and it's apparently immediately sent to this place, which is called a school and even a reform school, but you make it very, very clear that it's sort of just a juvenile prison which goes by the name of a school. And so we have this main character who is such a good a pupil, and so his grandmother is very proud of him, and he works at a shop for a white employer, and the employer is also very proud of him, and so you think he will go far in life. And then he arrives there at this place, and at first it seems he doesn't really understand where he is. So is it fair to say that he is also being this good pupil, he is also a little bit naive?
He's naive. I mean, he's never experienced a place like the Nickel Academy before. He's a very optimistic person. He thinks that the world can be changed. The book takes place in 1963, and I could have had it happen in 85 or 2010 or 1926, but I picked 63 because it's the height of the civil rights movement, but also the height of Jim Crow, the series of laws that controlled and restricted life, black life and liberty in the South. And so you have the idea of possibility, but also the idea of these very entrenched systems. And so Elwood has seen racial progress in his life. He's seen Martin Luther King march. He's seen advances in terms of legislation in his lifetime, and he sees himself as part of this generation that's changing America. Is he naive? Well, without those kind of hopeful people like Elwood or Martin Luther King, who believe that the system can be changed, nothing ever happens. And so he is naive, he is a fool, but we need these people or else nothing good ever comes of things.
At first we hear about him there is this man of his name who lives in New York in the present, and who also reads the stories about the school the so-called school he went to. And then we meet young Elwood, and he's listening to a record, and listening to a record again and again, and you say it's the one record he owns. So at first you think, well, maybe sort of he's that kind of pupil who always wants to learn, so he just listens to this one record, because it's not a music record, but it's a record of the speeches of Martin Luther King. And then I think as the story unfolds, sort of you as a reader, you get in a sense second thoughts that sort of there are reasons why Elwood never in his life actually was able to acquire another record.
Well, I mean, I picked 63. I picked Elwood, an optimistic, hopeful character. So I was thinking who he'd be inspired by, and then quickly came to Martin Luther King. And of course, now you can go on YouTube and then see Dr. King's speeches. But at the time, the sort of mode of transmission was the record. So he has this vinyl 78, and he plays it over and over, listening to Dr. King's words. We talked about naivete before. What was great about writing the book was going back to Dr. King's speeches and thinking which ones would work for Elwood, the character, which ones would speak to the larger theme. And so I got to listen to Dr. King's voice and realize that he was naive as well. But without that kind of courage and an insight to human character and visionary nature, a lot of good work would not have been done. And so Elwood was inspired by Dr. King, and also was inspiring for me decades later to come back to his words.
So this so-called system of education in this in the school is as Elwood then discovers, is actually totally arbitrary. So as far as there is any sort of system or method to it, the method is sort of you are never sure of your life. You're always in danger. You can't even be sure sort of if you behave and if you follow commands they will spare you. The wardens of this what is in fact a prison. And so at many times within this system, it's then the case that boys are punished for things they didn't do, as in fact is also maybe the case with this story about how Elwood got there, because he wasn't the thief of the car he was found in. And so Philip Hensher, the British writer, when he reviewed the novel in The Spectator, he said there is this theme of a mistaken identity going through it, and he had the impression sort of that you're working with this idea of mistaken identity has something about the American history, especially the history of the African Americans, which you tell through this example. Is there something about this idea of Hensher's?
People, you write something and people have theories about it. I'll leave it at that.
Yes, And I encourage you to read the book, of course, to read it yourself, but also to think about this idea of henches. As many reviewers pointed out, it's a very well-built novel. It's not a long novel, as you can see. So you are taken sort of into the world of this of the Nickel Academy. And
yeah, I mean, you know, when I start a project, I try to figure out how it's going to work. Is it a realistic novel, a fantastic novel, a longy, a shorty? Those are official writing terminology. That's I knew it would be short and compact. I knew that it would focus on the two main characters, Elwood, his friend Turner, who's an orphan and stuck in the Nickel Academy. Whereas the Underground Railroad, you know, goes to different alternative Americas and is sort of rebooting every 60 pages and requires a more complicated structure, I knew that a short, concise format would work for the story of Elwood and Turner.
And then in the third part of the novel, we also have another place of action, and actually another time, and you move back and forward in time and take the story of one of the survivors to the present. There is a construction company run by Elwood Curtis now. So what made you sort of shift the point of view in the later part?
Two-thirds of the book takes place at Nickel Academy, and a third takes place in New York as we follow a grown-up Elwood as he tries to find his way in life. There's a lot of despair in the Nickel Academy sections, but it was important to me to narrate the progress of a person to selfhood. We understand trauma and PTSD and how you come back from deforming life experiences. And so Elwood has been put off track. How does he find his way to wholeness, to having a coherent self? And so we catch up with him in the 1970s and 80s in New York as he tries to recover from this event, his incarceration at Nickel Academy, that's put him off course. And some of the kids don't make it. You know, and going through the survivor stories of people who were at Dozier, the real life school, some of them became hardened criminals, alcoholics, addicts, were never able to form a stable family unit because they've been so traumatized by their 18 months at Nickel. And so it was important to have a realistic depiction of Dozier, but also to narrate, you know, the progress of the self, to show the story of someone who tries to put his life together after this terrible event.
After the book came out, you also went to Florida and gave readings there. And one journalist of one of the Florida papers did an interview with you and asked you whether you had ever gone and see the actual place. And at that time, you said before you wrote the book, you didn't go. Did you in the meantime when you were down there?
No, you know, I mean, I think the further I got into the book and the further I got into Elwood and Turner's stories and the stories of the survivors, the more I recoiled at the thought of going to the place. For me, it was a place of evil, and you'd only go there with a stick of dynamite and a bulldozer. That's how I sort of felt the further I got into the book. A year and a half ago, Hurricane Michael ravaged Florida and actually destroyed a lot of the buildings. So if you see it now, all the places I write about are ruined, and nature has sort of reclaimed a lot of them. And but still, I mean, I have no intention of going.
So did this is this a special case with the novels you wrote before? Did you sometimes go to the places if they were actual places? For example, did you?
Yeah, I mean, it's always nice to get your real writer badge and go into the field and sometimes it's necessary. With both Underground Railroad and this book, a lot of the primary materials that were really important to me were first-person testimonies. And the more research I can do from home, generally the happier I am, because when you leave the house, there's so many, what's the word, people. And if I can avoid human interaction on a daily basis, it's generally a win for Coulson. Yeah.
So was there, after you published the book, some interaction with the actual survivors? Did people get in touch with you, and did have some of them read the book?
Yeah, I mean, you know, traveling in the South, I met people who lived in the town that was closest to Dozier, and some of them would say, oh yeah, we knew all about it, and some people would say, I knew nothing about it, so that was very interesting. I met people whose uncles had gone there, and they would talk about how Uncle Billy went in one way, and he was there for a year, and then came back, was never changed. He would never talk about what happened there. And then there was one student who reached out to me, and like Elwood, he moved to New York in the late 70s, and he actually lived two blocks away from where I put Elwood. And we both lived in the same neighborhood, so we had lunch, and he told me about his time there. And contrary to most of the survivor stories, he said it was actually one of the most important times in his life. He learned discipline. He was like a truant, cutting school before he went there. But he learned a trade. It set him on the right track. And when he described, he was taken to the White House, the place where they did the beatings. And it was just very, you could, and he was sort of miming what he would do, like gripping the bed when the leather strap would come down. So you could see that it had, he said he'd gotten something good out of it, like discipline, but the punishments were still very close to his psychology. I mean, when he was telling me these stories about getting beaten, he was obviously transported back to that place, so.
Elwood at one time thinks about the ways to go away there, the ways to escape. So there is the official way, just sort of to graduate, and there's the way that you die, and there's the way that you run away. Would sort of entering the world of literature, the world of fantasy, would that also be, we know that he's a reader, he tries to find those books which he can get his hands on. There, nobody else is interested in those books, but he manages to find some old Victorian novels there. So is this also a way to escape from this cruel institution?
Well, I think Elwood's more of a non-fiction guy, so I'm not sure why. I mean, you know, one thing about being a novelist on the road is that you sit next to folks on planes or at the hotel bar, and they'll say, what do you do? And I'm like, I write fiction. And they're like, novels? And I was like, yeah, novels. And they say, I don't read novels, I read nonfiction. And so Elwood definitely strikes me as a nonfiction guy.
Fortunately for the Elwoods of this world, there are also some books in your oeuvre. You wrote a big book about your hometown, the town of New York, and you also wrote a book about the game of poker. And this was what I discovered when I checked the catalog of the Deutsche Nationalbibliothek, that this book actually wasn't published yet in Germany. But I hope very much that Hansa now we'll have every reason also to publish this, as you now have this big group of fans also over here in Germany, which will continue to grow, I'm sure, as you continue your travels this week.
You never know. You never know.
Yeah, so good luck on your travels in Germany. Und Ihnen vielen Dank, meine Damen und Herren, dass Sie uns heute Nachmittag hier zugehört haben. Ihnen noch gute Eindrücke hier auf der Frankfurter Buchmesse.
Thank you and thank you for listening.